Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
We are live, everybody. It is Pollock and Thurston for Wednesday, March the 20th of 2024. We have a stacked show for you folks. Not only one, but two guests that will be joining us today because we have multiple lawsuits to discuss. And in the case of one, we have a massive settlement because it turns out that, TKO's budget for settling antitrust cases and allegations of anti-competitive behavior. Well, it turns out that the UFC fighters at least fared better than MLW, I guess. They got hundreds of millions more, but regardless, a figure that is going to be debated and dissected until we get further clarification on what this is going to mean for all the fighters. But essentially, Brandon, both antitrust cases, the one led by Kung Lee, which was filed in 2014, and then a later antitrust case filed by Cajun Johnson and CB Dolloway, both have been settled for the aggregate amount of $335 million that will be broken up and paid over a period of time and that TKO believes will be deductible for tax purposes. And now their antitrust problems are gone. There's no trial in April. And there's no forthcoming case in regards to the Cajun Johnson case that was just in the background of all of the focus on the Kung Lee case. So you know what? They cut a check and it's gone. It's done.
This is all good news. Even TKO getting into the aggregation game, it's a tax write-off. And $335 million sounds like a lot of money to me anyway. But if you look at the stock and look at what TKO stock is doing right now, TKO, the stock market is loving this. The TKO shareholders are just digging in for more. It is up 7% as we speak right now. As we confirmed, in fact, off air, as we were about to go to air here, what does that mean? What does that mean for Vince McMahon's market capital?
I have not seen anyone yet online get to this conclusion yet until Brandon and I. What? How much money did this settlement mean for Vince McMahon's profitability today?
He's got, so Vince, after his most recent stock transactions, now has about 15 million shares, and if you just do the math, he's gained about $90 million in on paper value based on just the fact that TKO shares have risen by more than 7% as of right now compared to when the market opened this morning. So Vince McMahon, even more wealthy because of this. And why would the stock market increase on the news that TKO is going to pay $335 million? Do you have any guesses?
Because the Kung Lee suit was asking for significantly more. And it's worth parsing the two antitrust cases because the Kung Lee case, it was strictly for like monetary damages. Whereas the Cajun Johnson case, it was not just money, but they were also seeking injunctive relief, which would have meant the potential of changes to the UFC contracts and would have much more structural changes to the UFC fighters and their rights. But getting back to the Kung Lee case, this was the gamble that they were taking. They could go to trial. They could end up with nothing at the end of this and some sizable legal fees when we're talking about 9 years of this case being alive. However, on the flip side, had they gone to trial and been awarded damages, because this is an antitrust case, they could have tripled the damages and we're going well into the billions at that point. So you're looking at the potential of a whole lot more that TKO could have been on the hook for. I don't look at $335 million as anything TKO is going to be losing sleep over. But this case, as much as Dana White said he has not thought about this case once, I think many people at the highest end of TKO, this is one less headache that they have to worry about the DNA of their business at all being interrupted by having to cut out more revenue for fighters or having to change language in their contracts where they cannot have such a iron grip on these fighters and where they can go and the ability to have more flexibility.
And so maybe we'll talk about this later. We have two attorneys joining us later in separate segments today. But you don't have any sense yet of who's going to get this $335 million, the fighters?
Yes. So the way I've understood this is that many of the fighters involved in the Cajun Johnson lawsuit, they have signed like the newest contracts. They had to sign over their ability to participate in any class action lawsuit. So the belief, and I will stand corrected if maybe Eric can give us a little more clarity. My understanding is that the lion's share of these damages are going to go to those that fought in the UFC between December of 2010 and June of 2017, which is the Kung Lee lawsuit period. It's broken up into two periods. So you can do the math here. And one expense we don't know is how much of this $335 million is going to go to the legal fees. I don't think that'll be an insignificant amount of money. Nor is it going to be insignificant what some of these fighters get. It's not going to be life-changing money, but they should all be getting, you know, if all of this makes sense, like they're going to be getting, you know, $250,000 potentially per fighter, which is not nothing. But
this is a class that covers what fighters? Fighters that fought between a certain date range?
Yes. Yeah. So post December 2010. So this is not going to help, you know, Keith Hackney, for instance, who was one of the pioneers in the UFC. But you know, we are talking about 1,200 fighters roughly that this does impact. But if this is not affecting future structural changes for the UFC, I mean, this means very little for your future fighters and any of the larger discrepancies that are at the heart of the industry of. Save for a union forming or something significant to that degree that we'll talk a little bit more with Eric McGraken, who will be on the show with us, as will Todd Martin from the PW Torch website. We're going to be talking with him about more of the legal aspects of the Janelle Grant lawsuit and some of the questions that we still have from a legal perspective that Todd might be able to give us a little more insight toward and sort of where we stand in the case. It's sort of at this moment right now where there has not been a whole lot of movement in the sense of where this is going. But I think it is a time to still look at some of the reporting we did last week, as well as the questions that still remain, and looking at it from a broader sense as well about kind of corporate culture and how this relationship was able to be so out in the open within this company. And Were there enough issues that this should have been raised and alarms should have gone off?
Yeah, and we have questions. You know, we're trying to find out more about WB policy in terms of what's allowed in WB and what they specifically have policies against or not. Another thing I want to go back to in terms of we've reported now through Front Office Sports that the four corporate officers are Nick Khan, Brad Blum, Stephanie McMahon, and Brian Nurse. WB has denied that a specific conversation that Janelle Grant alleges took place, that she was told took place by Vince McMahon, involving Vince McMahon, Nick Khan, and Brad Blum concerning Janelle Grant. WB denies that conversation took place. I think it's noteworthy that WB did not deny that Nick Khan or Brad Blum had knowledge of a relationship between Vince McMahon and Janelle Grant. They deny that they had knowledge of the assaults that Grant alleges occurred, but don't deny
knowledge of the relationship. That was not denied. And I guess that is sort of where we have to work from. Like, let us give all benefit of the doubt that all they were aware of was Vince McMahon was involved with an employee. Just at that base level, should there have been actions taken? Were there actions that could have been taken? What could they have done? And then complicating matters is when it's not just Vince is involved with an employee in a relationship, but they're also seeing a massive promotion for that person. Now we're talking about company funds that are benefiting, you know, Vince McMahon is benefiting this person he's in a relationship with company funds. And I think that further adds to the scrutiny that different corporate officers with knowledge of this relationship are going to face.
And I think it's also worth noting that in the case of Nick Khan, who is not only the president of WB both then and now, and also a member of the board of directors, Brad Blum is not a member of the board of directors, but he is still currently the COO of the company. But in the case of Nick, and I suppose to an extent, Stephanie McMahon was a member of the board of directors as well. But my point I want to make is, in the case of Nick Khan, who was a member of the board of directors, who was a member of the board of directors at the time that they wrote the letter to Vince saying, we don't think it's prudent that in the interest of shareholders that you come back to the company right now. This is December 2022. We think you should not come back despite your letter to us that you want to come back. And then he does come back, forces his way back in because he has the voting power at that time. And then a number of board members, including Stephanie McMahon and Manjit Singh and Ignacy Laude, resign. Alan Wexler and I believe another member of the board of directors who's independent is removed as a part of the process of Vince putting himself back on the board. So it's a lot of board turnover there. Some members, though, stay on. One is Nick Khan, and they approve. They vote to approve of Vince McMahon as the executive chairman. So there's that happening in terms of, you know, Nick approving of Vince to be back on the board after this investigation has took place where he, you would think, has some knowledge and has learned some things about what Vince McMahon has done around the company, around the company culture. But whether or not he learned of the details that have been anywhere near the neighborhood of the details that are alleged in the Grant lawsuit in terms of the graphic descriptions of sexual assault is a question. But he has approved of Vince becoming executive chairman in January 2023. And in addition to that, what makes him different, I think, than Brad Blum even and Stephanie McMahon is that he has approved of that, but also he went on Bill Simmons' podcast and pretty solidly defended Vince McMahon in January 2023. And as recently as a couple days before the Grant lawsuit came out on January 23rd, he went on Pat McAfee's show and is still along with Pat McAfee sort of singing the praises of Vince McMahon. Without Vince McMahon, there would be nothing here. So it just raises a lot of questions around what he knew, the details of what he knew. They deny that they had knowledge of the abuse at the time, I think is how I read their comment, not necessarily whether they had knowledge or not of the abuse further down the road.
Right. I want to give a mention to the Trish and Sarah Wrestling podcast. They do a really great job on this week's show of kind of breaking down the case and going through the details that were out there and a lot of pertinent questions that still remain. I mean, you can look at these different factors. I mean, John Laurinaitis was fired almost instantly after the first Wall Street Journal report. I mean, that was enough of something of the WWE. They were just identifying him as, I don't know, it was kind of this vague term that they were referring to him as rather than John Laurinaitis by name. But also the fact that this was, you know, at the very latest, all of these corporate officers had to be aware of what was out there by June of 2022, when the first Wall Street Journal report came out. And I think, to me, a lot of this always goes back to the investigation that closed in 2022 and what was discovered in this multi-million-dollar investigation that went into Vince McMahon, and that their end result was when Vince McMahon did come to the board to try and return, they voted unanimously for him not to return. What was discovered in this investigation? We know that there was, at least as one of the board members had stated, outreach to Janelle Grant, but Janelle Grant not participating in that investigation. But we know.
And you're talking about Jeffrey Speed, who led the investigation, who told the New York Times that they had outreach to Janelle Grant, and which was a response to Janelle Grant saying in the lawsuit that she was not interviewed, nor were documents requested from her. So I think it's plausible that the investigation didn't uncover these allegations of sexual assault that Grant alleges, or in any other case for that matter. Although we do have allegations, you know, going all the way back to Rita Chatterton of rape by Vince McMahon in 1986. We have allegations at the Boca Raton tanning salon in 2006. We have allegations that were uncovered, at least in the Wall Street Journal, about assault that occurred in the 2010s. Coming from a California spa manager. So there are a number of allegations of assault, maybe perhaps not in the detail that the Grant complaint alleges. That's, you know, when we all read that complaint, that's a whole new level of graphic detail. But nonetheless, you've got to be aware of a number of allegations at that point by January 2023 of things, including assault and rape for that matter.
And to this point, not to say that they have been front and center in a public space to be asked about it, but, you know, Ari Emanuel and Mark Shapiro, I think, are two people that are still very outstanding figures in the sense that we have not heard them comment in any kind of on the record setting about this. And
we have a TKO comment, but not from them personally.
Not from them personally, and not in any kind of a situation where they could let us in on what their thought process was going through the period where they are doing their due diligence into the company and knowing the fact that, I mean, Ari Emanuel has been someone very outspoken about others when it comes to, sexual assault allegations.
Including CAA's co-chairs around Harvey Weinstein being enabled. We did have Mark Shapiro, though, make it really clear that Vince McMahon is not
going
back.
That is true. Yes. Not so much going into, their process, but I mean, making it very clear that Vince McMahon is not coming back to this company, and we do not know.
We don't have conversations with him. We don't talk to him. He's not coming back.
We don't know this man in any form or fashion. We are going to welcome in our first of two guest folks. You're getting a blockbuster edition of Pollock and Thurston today. You can see all of his work over at the Pro Wrestling Torch website. The co-host of The Fix alongside Wade Keller, returning to Pollock and Thurston, he is the one and only, the great Todd Martin, who is here with us. Hello, Todd.
Yeah, pleasure to be with you guys. And yeah, I heard it made clear that they don't even bowl with Vince McMahon anymore. None of that. They're not having anything to do with the guy.
Nothing at all. Mark Shapiro.
I heard bowls for the George Barrios and Michelle Wilson were big bowls. Well, they ran Bolero as well. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Todd, we wanted to bring you on to kind of pick your brain a little bit about where we stand at the moment involving the Janelle Grant lawsuit. And sort of just from a larger perspective, some of the overarching questions you still have that hopefully we get answers to. Is there still a lot of there's still a lot of distance between questions and answers when it comes to this case and how further into the process we get if this actually does make it to a trial?
Yeah, I mean, questions about this is very broad because there's so many different angles that I'm curious about where this goes. I mean, I guess if I'm sort of thinking broadly about questions I have about this, three areas are of most interest to me. And, you know, maybe there's something else, other things that, someone else could bring up and be like, oh, yeah, that's actually maybe even better than one of these as far as points to follow. One is whether we have more women coming forward. This has been something discussed for a long period of time. There have, of course, it's come out that there have been other NDAs followed. As this becomes more public and as Vince McMahon has decreased power, no power at this point within the industry, do we see more people coming forward and how does that complicate things in terms of this story? Number two is the cover-up or the, potential cover-up. And that's been something that's been shrouded in a lot of mystery for a while. Obviously, there was a vote to kick Vince McMahon out, and then there was a vote where he, rearranged the board of directors and they voted to bring him back in. There was the report that was, that was released. A lot of questions about how that report was done, what exactly it found, what people were aware of. What was, aware of? When was he aware of it? What was Triple H aware of? When was he aware of it? Stephanie, a lot of questions about the response to, the breaking, the breaking of the information about this. And I mean, the more, the greater amount of information in terms of once they became aware that Janelle Grant was alleging very strong allegations of misconduct on the part of Vince McMahon, not simply him hiring her for a job that seemed, quite suspicious in terms of what her qualifications were and what she would be doing for that job. That is, discussed in Janelle Grant's suit and was, the subject of what you guys reported on last week. I think it was last week. It was very recently. And
feels like a lot longer by now, but yes.
Yes. So the more, that, and there's a lot of information on that already. I'm even more interested in terms of when they became aware of an even more problematic relationship than I say simply with quotes, with air quotes, simply what was originally alleged. And then three, I'm also very curious about how Vince McMahon responds to this. My strong assumption is that TKO will be looking to settle this at some point. And, you know, as I've discussed at points in the show I do with Wade and elsewhere, I'm curious what Vince McMahon's mentality in this is. Is his mentality going to be, yeah, make this thing go away, throw some money at her, and let's just be done with this? Or is his mentality going to be, you know, this woman has, you know, very, you know, has decimated my reputation, and I want to push back as much as I can to try to put out my side of the story such as it is, and to, more importantly, I think from his perspective, to make her look bad and bring up, you know, potential inconsistencies in her story and the nature of the relationship. And I'm not sure whether he'll want this to go away or whether at this point he'll think, hey, I got nothing left to lose here. I want, you know, some of the stuff to get out from my side. And I'm not sure what the answer is. I think there are more people that think he's just going to want this to go away, but I'm not as convinced on that point.
When it comes to, you know, your following of Vince McMahon's career, how much do you feel that he, especially now at the age he is at, cares about his legacy? Because this is always that person that I think to the outside wrestling world has wanted to be able to present people that he is this, you know, he is somebody that has, you know, through all of his non-wrestling projects, wanted to legitimize himself in the eyes of those. And certainly we could do a laundry list of all the things that would be negatives on his legacy. But this is one that is going to be so damning to his entire world. It overrides everything. Do you think that is something that at Vince McMahon's core is something that he would be very much concerned about?
Yes, but I'm not sure how much. I mean, I think he likely cares less than a lot of public figures would. I think he's someone that has been used to, playing the villain role for such a long period of time that he's more content to just sort of be himself and say what he thinks and not concern himself as much with that. I mean, we saw that, you know, two decades now back with that infamous Armin Katayan interview where he knocked the papers out of the hand and was just, you know, angry and whatnot. Like that is not a way that even a very frustrated executive in most industries would act. And, you know, it says a lot of things. It says sort of like about him not, you know, not being used to being challenged. It says his sort of willingness to try to bully people, but it also speaks to him not caring very much about how he's perceived, because a lot of people, you know, the reason they wouldn't act that way is because they don't want people thinking of them as the sort of person that would act that way. And so Vince McMahon is somebody that, and I mean, he portrayed himself as the villain, and, you know, now there's all the, you know, all the different clips of him over the years acting in extremely creepy and troubling ways on his own television show, in ways that he, you know, okayed and approved, and I think in many instances enjoyed. And a lot of people would not like that if they were very concerned about their reputation. So I think he, insofar as everybody is concerned about the reputation to some degree, and he is a public figure, as you note, he's been trying to redefine his sort of legacy and make himself to be more than just a wrestling promoter, which we saw through his, you know, the advent of the alternative terms to describe the industry, to the, you know, the WBF, to the XFL. He's made a lot of, you know, efforts over the years to try to up his overall legacy and make himself seem impressive. But I think on the flip side, he's also okay with being the villain. With that said, nobody wants to be framed the way that he was in the context of this lawsuit. And, you know, this is, as you mentioned, extremely damning on his reputation and something that, you know, I think is going to come up in the first sentence, not the first paragraph, the first sentence of his obituary. And, you know, I think that's quite the incentive for him to want to try to reframe this insofar as he can. But, you know, he's more aware than anyone else of how difficult that's going to be given the, you know, what are already established facts on the ground and then a whole bunch of stuff that have not been established as facts, but certainly there's plenty of reason to believe to be true.
And Todd, do you have any sense of, as far as WWE's liability here, did did Nick Khan in particular, maybe because he's a member of the board of directors, but also Brad Blum for that matter, being an executive, did they have any fiduciary duty once they became aware of this relationship? They may not have been aware of the assaults that Grant alleges, but once they became aware of this relationship, did they have any sort of fiduciary duty to the company to try to intervene, even though Vince is above them?
Well, there's sort of two levels that they would be, they would have obligations. I mean, one is just on the internal level, WWE, I'm sure, has a corporate handbook and, has policies related to all sorts of different, corporate responsibilities. And, internally, I'm sure they have, internal regulations about what to do if you become aware of, conduct that's detrimental to the overall good of the company or conduct that is potentially illegal. The second would be on the, on the civil level in terms of, as you mentioned, fiduciary duties and as corporate officers. And yeah, you have fiduciary duties to act in the best interest as an officer of the company, in the interest of the company. I don't think that's ultimately going to end up being key to the way the situation develops, in the sense that it's not really key to this particular lawsuit. And I think it's possible, but I think less likely that corporate shareholders would end up in litigation against the officers responding to Vince McMahon. I think if they were going to bring that sort of litigation, it would be more likely to go against Vince McMahon. Where the key is to their responsibilities and their role in this is Janelle Grant's attempts to tie WWE to the actions of Vince McMahon, because it's not a given when someone acts in the way that Vince McMahon did, that the company is going to be responsible. A company is responsible for an employee's actions only if it's in the course and scope of employment. So, for example, if you're working at McDonald's and you accidentally spill coffee on a customer, McDonald's is very clearly responsible. You're trying to serve coffee. That is, that is a job. And whether you did it, accidentally or, obviously be accidentally, but whether you did it on the basis of negligence or whether you wouldn't say that the person is negligent for it, it would still be the responsibility of the company. By contrast, let's say, you guys post wrestling, you decide you want to open up a corporate offices in Buffalo. You want to break into the American market. It's right across,
across
the border. so you open up your post wrestling offices in Buffalo, and John, you come down and work out of there some days, and Wei's down there sometimes, and Brandon, you're there more often because it's, closer to home for you. And you've got, all sorts of post things going on there. You've got, you're recording podcasts there. You've got merchandise you're selling to people. You host events there, but unbeknownst to you, John, Brandon is running an illegal Fabergé egg theft business. So he's stealing Fabergé eggs and he's selling them on the black market.
Fabergé. I don't even know what that word means.
It's those little expensive, little expensive eggs. And so he's selling these, he's stealing these things illicitly and then he's selling them. Okay. Now he's doing it out of the post wrestling offices. He's doing it using, he's using his office there. He's got them in the post wrestling office. He's doing it during the workday. That's the basis of where he's doing it. But you have no awareness, John. He's just doing this on his own. You don't know this is going on. The people that he steals the eggs from become aware of this. They want to sue Brandon, but unfortunately Brandon has gone off and he's used the money on, he's just gambled it away. He's a degenerate gambler. He's spending all the money away. He has no money. So that they say, hey, let's sue post wrestling. They do it at the office. This is the company that he works for. We should be able to get the money from post wrestling. It's unlikely they're going to be able to, because that's not the course and scope of employment. That has nothing to do with what he's doing for post wrestling, stealing these Fabergé eggs. It's not something that has anything to do with the company, and the company has nothing to do with it. And that's why, as part of this lawsuit, there's so much of a focus on not just Vince McMahon's actions, but the company's actions, how they responded to it, their awareness of it, the fact that it was tied into the Brock Lesnar contract talks. They want to tie this into WWE business in a way to say that this, you can't separate what Vince McMahon was doing from what the company was doing, that they were a part of facilitating it, allowing it to happen, and that they even benefited from it in the fact that, you know, the Brock Lesnar negotiations resulted in a contract that had something to do with this. So that's the key to the whole thing, is tying the company in to the action so the company can be responsible for what in another context it would just be Vince McMahon doing things that are terrible, but he's doing outside of the bounds of the company. And in fact, the company shouldn't have been happy with him doing that, because it's not in the company's interest for, you know, for him to be using company funds to pay for, you know, for this relationship with this woman that has nothing really to do with the company.
If my Fabergé egg scheme, though, cost post-wrestling a lot of money in you know, to make a legal settlement or something like that, would then post-wrestling have there be merit in suing me over my, you know, over the damages purportedly I've caused post-wrestling with my gambling and Fabergé scheme?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if, you know, if WWE had not been, you know, apparently as potentially aware at different stages of what Vince McMahon was doing, and potentially, you know, based on, you know, what some of the information that's come out potentially involved in the cover up afterwards, that's something that I, in fact, would think would not be such a an improbable event. I don't think it's going to happen, because I don't think they're going to want to bring any more attention to this whole thing. But yeah, WWE, absolutely. And even under the facts that we have, I mean, I think they've got a pretty decent case for Vince McMahon being responsible for damage to the company. Again, I don't expect them to do it, but I think there's a case there, even knowing what we know about their response to it.
And I think it's notable along those lines that clearly WWE/TKO has charged Vince McMahon for the cost of the investigation, which we continue to see in filings.
Yep. Yeah. And later there was the switching around of funds in terms of the NDAs. So yeah, I mean, at the point that they became aware of the depths of what Vince McMahon was doing, I mean, I think there were a lot of people, you know, behind the scenes in that company who were, you know, not just, I mean, obviously there was anger and frustration at the fact he was doing this to another human being, allegedly, but also the damage he was doing to the company, because it's, you know, it has done a lot of damage, both reputationally and I think in the future financially to the company.
If we distill this down to simply the relationship existing between Vince McMahon and a lower level employee such as Janelle Grant, how much is that, can that be considered a consensual relationship given the disparity in positions in the company from a Vince McMahon to an employee? If that's all we are talking about here, is it something that's frowned upon, or are we going a step further that this is something that in a post-Me Too environment is something that no company of this level is tolerating, or is it somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting subject. It's something that that Brandon and I have chatted about in the context of this as well, outside of this chat. And certainly over time, and this is an ongoing discussion, and I wouldn't say battle, but an ongoing sort of discussion about how to implement the topic of consent as you mentioned in the context of imbalance of power, because, you know, generally speaking, you know, consent, if you've got two adults that are both aware of the situation, then they consent. You know, one, you know, general outlier in terms of how consent is perceived is that, you know, is statutory rape, where you cannot consent if you're under a certain age because of both, you know, the imbalance of power, but also just the development of the mind. And because of that, I think there's been a movement to expand how we conceptualize what consent means. I think that even in a case where we start to expand that definition to where you've got a worker that has such an imbalance of power, and that we might start concluding in certain situations that is a matter of law in certain contexts, we would consider it to be consent not able to be to be given. I would think it would be more difficult in this case simply because Janelle Grant has been, even in her filing, upfront about recognizing the nature of the relationship from relatively pretty early on. This isn't the case of, you know, somebody that's been working in the company for, you know, for years, let's say as a secretary, and then one day the boss starts coming on to him or her. In that context, you could say there's so much difficulty in being able to navigate that situation that it's difficult to give consent when if you say no to this person, you might lose your job. And that's, you know, that's sort of the basis of, you know, a lot of why we've been sort of reconsidering, you know, the nature of sexual harassment law and things like that. But this one is more, you know, it isn't that. It's not someone that, mm-hmm. Got into this company, not really know what was going on. It was someone that got this job knowing that it was on the basis of this kind of sketchy relationship with Vince McMahon. And at that point, well, certainly he can still be held responsible for then expanding that into bounds that were completely beyond the realm of acceptability, based on what the original understanding was. Not to mention, she alleges that there was just flatly non-consensual sex involved as well. But that's a different situation. You know, you can still hold them responsible without saying consent can't be formed when she was, you know, she was an adult that went in there basically knowing what the arrangement was or thinking she knew what the relationship was going to be. And you could say there was consent at the beginning. And then at some point it became, you know, it became a lot harder to justify, you know, the position that she was being put in, obviously.
And I think that also opens it up to, again, the responsibilities of the corporate officers in this setting of what levers were at their disposal, like what guardrails were in place that you could have checks and balances for Vince McMahon on a board of directors that we have clear evidence of that this board of directors was ultimately powerless if Vince McMahon was adamant about pushing something through, like save for going to the authorities for something that they deemed to be illegal that was going on. I mean, that's kind of this entire power vacuum that was constructed with Vince McMahon at the top of this company and those underneath him that were in these positions of ultimately, like this, everything had to funnel through Vince, and he had this unchecked power at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the danger of absolute power in any context, you know, that when you've got power very much concentrated at the top, it leads to corruption and lack of checks and balances. It's why, you know, democracy is the best of, you know, the best of political systems of a bunch of bad systems. You know, and it's why, you know, when you've got a company, you want to have checks and balances within the company to prevent one person from being able to run amok. And Vince McMahon was, you know, in control of that company for such a long period of time that he clearly felt that he was above the law and he could do what he wanted. And, you know, that it you have to have a lot of unchecked, uncontrolled power to act in the way that he was acting, because, you know, you have to be aware of how other people are going to perceive that type of behavior.
Well, Todd, we want to thank you very much for jumping on with us to chat about this very complex subject that we will be continuing to discuss. You can find all of Todd's work over at pwtorch.com. Himself and Wade Keller always giving you a thorough rundown of everything going on in professional wrestling and mixed martial arts with The Fix, which you can sign up on the VIP portion of PW Torch and the top book reviews in the entire industry, courtesy of one Todd Martin. Are there any on your to read list? There's actually quite a slew of books that are coming up over the next couple of weeks, Todd.
Yeah, I'm just about done with the biography on Randy Savage that was just released. So that's coming either tomorrow or next week. But the one that jumped out today for a lot of people is the Ronda Rousey book. I thought her first book was quite interesting, and she was very honest, and it was I thought a very engaging read. And she has some, you know, uncompromising, you know, quotes in terms of her, you know, with the way that she talks about WWE in this new book. So I'm going to be quite curious about that one. The Becky Lynch book is one that I'm I'm looking forward to a lot as well. And one that is a little bit longer down the road, from my understanding as well, is Stephen Johnson, who wrote along with Greg Oliver, a number of exceptional books on wrestling, is doing a biography of Jim Londo. So I'm very much looking forward to as well. And just in terms of you wrapping up, it's always a pleasure to be on with you guys. So have a good rest of the day.
Thanks a lot, Todd. We'll talk soon.
And no homework. I hope you appreciated it this time.
Yes, always good not to have too much to think about the night before.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you, Todd. All right, everybody. That was Todd Martin, and we're now going to leap on over to our next guest because we had the news coming out earlier today. The UFC has made all their antitrust issues go away to the tune of $335 million. Joining us now is Eric McGrakan, back on the show with us. Eric, thank you so much for joining us. It's a big news item for the UFC, and I guess several hours removed. Was this an outcome that you sensed was an expected one? And what are some of your overall thoughts now that you have seen the filing and the figure that was arrived at for the UFC in these two cases?
Yeah, John, thanks for having me on. The first thing I'll say is this settlement isn't set in stone.
No.
It has to be approved by the court. And yeah, thanks for putting this up on the screen. That's the SEC filing that the UFC's parent company just put out. And so that's why this is public news. It's basically saying that you got this 300 some odd million dollar payment and these antitrust lawsuits go away. But the next step is the parties to the lawsuit have to bring it in front of the federal judge who's been overseeing this lawsuit, and that court has discretion about whether to approve it or not. Before I have any real views on it, I actually need to know more, because what I don't know, and I've been reaching out to a few contacts hoping to get an answer, what I don't know is if the $335 million is the whole settlement. Financially, I'm sure that's the whole settlement. But what I want to know is there anything else to it? Because the fighters behind this antitrust lawsuit for years have been talking about structural change and somehow correcting the market imbalance that the UFC has over fighters. And I don't know if the UFC is simply paying money or if they're going to agree to certain contractual changes in terms of how they do business. I'd love to know the answer to that, but nobody's saying anything publicly about that at that time. So I think all of us have to sort of collectively hold off judgment about whether this is good or bad until they file their full materials for court approval.
Anything you can share in terms of like the role of the judge in this case? I mean, is this a situation where the judge could look at this and state that, for instance, feels that the fighters are being taken advantage of in this settlement? I mean, what role can the judge play when both parties are stating we are in agreement to this settlement and the terms of it?
Yeah. So in a class action lawsuit, it's a little bit unique because you have basically one person, the class representative, representing 1,200 fighters, everybody who's been brought into this lawsuit and who hasn't opted out. And so for that reason, just because the plaintiff agrees and the defendant agrees, normally that's all you need for a deal to get done. But here, because 1,200 fighters are going to be impacted by the settlement, the court does have that oversight process. And the court does have the ability to reject the proposed settlement, even though both sides want it. I'm not making any predictions there. I need to know a lot more. But to oversimplify it, what the court's looking for is whether it's an adequate settlement. So whether this money and whatever else has been agreed to adequately represents the interests of the 1,200 fighters in the Lee class action. And this SEC filing also mentions it's going to settle the Johnson class action, which is interesting because the Johnson class action's in its early stages. It hasn't been certified yet. So I have to make some assumptions here, but presumably the parties are going to consent to the Johnson case being certified as a class action. And then this settlement will cover everybody who would be caught up in that lawsuit as well. So I don't know. Need to know more details about how Johnson is going to be disposed of here as well. But yeah, the court does have real power to oversee this and to make sure it's an adequate settlement. And the court's going to have a whole bunch of information to work with to make that decision. Fighters who are part of the class action lawsuit also have an opportunity to object. So basically it works in a two-stage process. There's a there's a preliminary approval of the settlement, and then the court makes sure all 1,200 fighters get notified. And then if any of them object to it, they could come to the court and raise their objections. So there's still a few layers of legal work that has to take place here before this is over the finish line. But my initial reaction, assuming the $330 million is all, and also assuming there's no injunctive relief, I think it's a big win for the UFC because they, you know, you put up the TKO stock, you saw what the market did. The market saw it that way. I think it went from 80 some odd dollars per share to close to 90, 87, 88 dollars per share. So it just skyrocketed as the news broke. And so the market views this as good for the UFC because it puts a whole lot of their past headaches behind them. But I also think it's early to make that judgment because if there is some sort of contractual change, I think we all need to know about that in engaging how good or bad the settlement is for everybody.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us, Eric. So I hear you saying that there's maybe $335 million is not everything that they might get, that they might get actual policy change from UFC out of this. And if you have any ideas of like, what would the plaintiffs be looking for along those lines?
Well, I know Lee case, they walked away from injunctive relief because it would have delayed the trial. And you know, they're basically saying they were going to pursue that in the Johnson case. My understanding is what they were looking for were 1 year exclusive contracts. So if the UFC is going to sign you and keep you under exclusive contract, they wanted to limit the UFC to 1 year. So every fighter could be a free agent within 12 months. So no champions clause, none of that stuff that ties people up perpetually for years in their top earning years. And that would be very healthy for the market if that kind of an order was made, because competing promoters could bid on these top fighters and top fighters could then play these promoters off each other and get paid very well. And there'd be more competition for the UFC because competing promoters could sign relevant fighters during their peak earning years. And so I know the fighters were going for that. Now, whether that kind of a change or something similar is going to be part of the settlement, we don't know. But presumably the court's going to grapple with that a little bit too, because Judge Boulware's comments in the certification decision and some of the other public reasons that the court released were very much on the fighter's side. Like, it seemed like the judge viewed this as a hell of a strong case. And so I'm really interested to see what the court's going to do with the settlement. And I'm also interested in seeing what other details are going to be part of it that we're not aware of right now.
I've also seen some discussion about how some of the language for the fighters in the under the Kung Lee suit might differ from those in the period for the Cajun Johnson case. Is there a difference in terms of like the damages that would be more weighted towards those on the Kung Lee case, or anything you can clarify regarding the different classes of fighters?
Yeah, John, I can only speculate there. I haven't seen anything reliable released publicly talking about that, so I don't want to guess and just make stuff up on the fly.
In terms of what we know about the latest contracts that the UFC has been signing fighters to, one of the areas of that language is that they cannot participate in class action lawsuits moving forward. So this is not a case of another antitrust lawsuit that could be looming. Like, they are preventing this from being a problem again. So by making these antitrust suits go away, this is, and they're also like looking forward that this is not going to be something that will be easy to restart again.
Yeah. I'll just change that a little bit.
Okay.
The clauses stop fighters from participating in class action lawsuits. It wouldn't prevent them from filing an antitrust lawsuit, which doesn't necessarily have to be a class action lawsuit, but economically, it only makes sense to do it that way. The one thing I find really interesting, and actually here, even before I say that, you're right, John. So if this gets approved and if there's no injunctive relief or if there's no contractual changes, the UFC have gone back in time to 2010 and basically cleaned up any potential wrongdoing on an antitrust front. And moving forward, where fighters can't participate in class actions, it's going to be much more unlikely that somebody files an individual antitrust claim. But the one thing I find interesting is other promoters could do what the fighters were doing. They could launch their own antitrust case against the UFC saying, hey, you guys are the big fish in this pond, you're subject to antitrust scrutiny. And all this stuff that the fighters complained about, that's hurting me. I can't compete against you because you've got the champion guy who's ranked number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, 10, 11 in this weight class lined up under these long-term exclusive contracts. I can't bid for their services. You guys are harming competition through all of these anti-competitive practices. And I'm just really curious, with all the money that's flowing around in the MMA competition world right now, if these promoters are going to take a kick at it. Look at what happened with golf when that LIV tour and the PGA started butting heads. Antitrust lawsuits started right away, right? They started making some allegations. I'm just really curious if one of these deep pocket competing MMA promoters wants to really shake the boat and bring an antitrust claim against the UFC.
And I'm wondering, Eric, if you have any sense of the fact that Endeavor is looking to go private right now, if that had any bearing on making the settlement happen. And I'm also just thinking in the larger scope of the TKO merger happening, does this make it easier for UFC to bear due to the fact that TKO is a larger company than UFC was alone?
Yeah. The nuances of their internal business structuring and taking aspects private, et cetera, I won't pretend to have any expertise there. But in terms of settlement, I think it's just the sure thing. Like, why wouldn't the UFC want this, whether they're public, whether they're private? If the fighters won, they could have been looking at north of $1 billion being awarded. They could have had that tripled. So, call it $3-4 billion. And then the Johnson case would be coming, where presumably those types of damages could have been repeated and presumably injunctive relief could have come. So the UFC's worst case scenario at trial was something which could have fundamentally undermined their business model. Like it could have delivered a blow that they wouldn't have recovered from. So settlement gives them a sure thing. And $335 million to you and me, that's a ton of money. But to the UFC, that ain't all that much. So I think they're coming across or getting away with some real good business certainty moving forward. That's my that's my overall impression here.
As we're looking towards this entire period, which goes back 9 years from when the Kung Lee suit was filed, you've been covering this really extensively, Eric. Did you take away any conclusions when it comes to the overall attitude of fighters in the midst of their careers regarding this issue? It seems to be one that, it's raised, but you also, it's not as though we had like unity on this subject either. And I just think it's a case that we can look at a lot of fighters that by the time that they're into their 50s and realizing, man, I left a lot on the table. I just feel that is going to be a cycle for a lot of these fighters that in the midst of their careers, they do not want to rock the boat. But there will come a time that they're going to look back at the revenues that this promotion is generating and how much did I contribute to those revenues and not have a worthy enough stake in.
Yeah. And that's almost married to the allegations of the lawsuit. Like the UFC is so big and so powerful that the fighter can't stand up to them. And so how much noise are these active guys under contract at the peak of their career going to do to the hand that feeds them, right? It's really tough to do that. And on the best of cases for the fighters, and again, we don't know what the settlement fully entails, but in the best case scenario for the fighters, they could have really corrected the market. You mentioned there's no unity. The one thing I would say is, when the class action was certified, it's an opt-out basis. So all of the fighters had the chance to opt out. They were notified. I know not every single fighter got actual notice, but most of them got notice. There was a pretty good campaign to get the word out. Gyms were notified. People were emailed. Letters were sent out, all that kind of stuff. I think not a single fighter opted out of the certification. And so to me, that's unity, right? You have 1,200 people sucked into this lawsuit. If any one of them was unhappy saying, hey, the UFC treated me great, they were fair, I have no beef with these guys, you would expect hundreds of fighters to opt out, but not a single one did. So I think when the rubber hits the road, that speaks volumes. And there's practical reasons not to opt out of a class action lawsuit. Like, you could get an easy check without doing anything. I get it. But to not have even one out of 1,200 opt out, that to me speaks to there being a certain amount of unity. And for the current fighters, there's probably more unity than they publicly express, but they're just they don't want to put their neck on the line. And it, you know, I get that. It's easy to criticize from the outside looking in, but if it's your check, you're feeding your family, your career, you don't want to rock that boat. I understand that. But yeah, I think when the fighters retire, they look back with, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and a lot of them do realize they got a raw deal.
I guess my follow-up to that would be if the idea of some kind of association were, say, 18 months from now, kicked around again. We saw what happened with Project Spearhead, and there wasn't a whole lot of backing for that project. Do you feel that maybe would be something that more fighters would be interested in now that they have gone through a cycle of working for the UFC for a number of years? Or do you feel like that's an opt-in measure, and that sometimes is a bit different than this opt out one, which, to your point, nobody did opt out of this case.
Yeah, no, you're right. Coming forward and proactively participating in a process is a little bit trickier. And who was it? It was Leslie Smith behind Project Spearhead. Yes. And she put her neck on the line. She did a hell of a good job too. She got really far. It was the Trump administration's NLRB that killed that in the water. But she, you know, she made some real waves with her lawyer. Now whether
while in the UFC as well, this is not somebody that was doing this from the outside. She was speaking about this publicly from within.
100%. Yeah. And her argument was by speaking publicly, they retaliated, right? They cut her before she fulfilled her last fight. And she claimed that was retaliation for her trying to unionize the athletes. And so she got pretty far there. And I think under the current administration, she would have gotten further. Just because of political differences. But this is the whole debate of, are they employees and can they unionize versus are fighters truly independent contractors? And that's its own lengthy discussion. I've got my own views on it. But if they're truly independent contractors, the one thing I'll say about the MMAFA, and that's Rob Macy's organization, and that's the organization that started this antitrust lawsuit. If this gets over the finish line with or without injunctive relief, they got $335 million for their fighters. That's a real result, right? And so if there's a place for fighters to congregate to and organize, MMAFA has been around for well more than a decade, and they're getting concrete results. They, you know, they did a good job trying to get the Alley Expansion Act going. This is going back several years ago, but that got, you know, sort of halfway across the finish line before it died in committee. They were behind this antitrust lawsuit. So there is a place for fighters to go to. And if they want to unionize, there could be another place for fighters to go to. But yeah, you know, it's just so tough after all these years and all these opportunities, the lack of current active fighters banding together publicly. It just hasn't happened. I don't know that it's going to happen, but you know, if you're a fighter and you want to make some change, reach out to the MMAFA because they, you know, their resume speaks for itself. Like, they have done good work over all these years, and reach out. If you think you should unionize, reach out to Lucas Middlebrook of Project Spearhead as well, because he's helped unionize other, you know, other professionals, and he knows the issue very well as well. But there are options for fighters who think they're getting shortchanged, and they don't necessarily have to be public figures. They could, you know, let lawyers do the heavy lifting for them.
Before we say goodbye, Eric, where can people go to seek out more of your work? You're always doing extensive research and analysis into a lot of these topics and similar ones. And it's, you know, vital information out there in the industry.
Oh, thanks, John. Website's combatsportslaw.com. So that's where I put together lengthier pieces, but I'm on Twitter most of the time. So if you go to X, my handle's just my name, Eric McGrack, and feel free to follow me there.
All right. Thank you so much, Eric, for joining us. We appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, Eric McGrakin joining us. You can go to combatsportslaw.com for more of this as the UFC, you know, pending a judge finalizing this, have settled their two outstanding antitrust suits. And thus, fighter pay has been solved, right, Brandon?
It's all good now. It's only a matter of time now before they unionize and then WWE follows suit.
Of course, yes, yes. As revenues grow, what is that magical WWE percentage? We will maybe that's a future project.
Yes, currently probably under 10%.
Under 10%. So we're talking like a significant amount less than what revenues are for UFC fighters as well. I don't know if that figure is going to be growing either. Before we get out of here, a few topics to hit on tonight. AEW is in Toronto. They are doing 3 hours live on TBS with Dynamite, followed by a Wednesday night edition of Rampage from the Coca-Cola Coliseum. The last update from WrestleTix has the show at over 6,100 tickets distributed. Tony Khan has proclaimed that tonight will be a sellout.
Are you sure? A sellout. This is the old Rico Coliseum, right? And even this tweet, which everybody can see on the WrestleTix Twitter right now, the last time that Dynamite was at the Rico Coliseum, at Coca-Cola Coliseum, it had 7,394 tickets out. Now, Tony Khan is saying tonight will be sold out. There's very few tickets remaining. And that may be the case, that the tickets they have put on sale are almost completely gone. But clearly, I mean, I don't see this event getting past 7,000. I would be surprised. In any case, you could say that it's just not set up for the same capacity that it was set up for last time. And I think it's stretching the meaning of a sellout there.
Yeah, I think the definition of sellout has somewhat been changed over time, where now the capacity setup is like technically, if you have a giant dinner table and you put two seats at the table and there are two bodies in those seats, the table's full, right?
Right. If we ran a show and it only consisted of seats, we only put seats on sale that were on the floor here, and we sold all of them, we would call that a sellout, perhaps. But when people think of, I think what the average person thinks of when they think of a sellout is that every seat that could be sold was sold. And I don't think that's the case here. I will have a tangent here in saying that in modern online ticket sales, you do have the platinum seats that people might be familiar with. When you find an event that has very, very few seats left, you will find that the few seats that are left are extremely expensive. Look at what's on sale left for WrestleMania, for example, where there's like some $5,000 tickets left. There are some $200 tickets left. But anyway, what will happen when you're nearly all gone is you'll have the platinum lift. You'll have the platinum tickets there that will be extremely highly priced, so that the event runner can get the maximum revenue out of the event. So that factors like that make these events almost impossible to truly be sold out in, I think, what the average person thinks of when they hear sellout. But we do have events. I think it is fair to say that the SmackDown events that WWE has been running lately have been virtually sold out for a streak here.
Yeah, they are now at 9 consecutive TV sellouts following this past Monday's episode in Raleigh, North Carolina. And it would seem that streak is going to continue. They are nearly full, if not already there, for Milwaukee on Friday. Obviously, next Monday in Chicago, they have expanded the capacity for the Allstate Arena for CM Punk in Chicago. And then after that, they're in Uncasville for SmackDown, and then the go-home Raw before Mania is at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, and they are heavily promoting The Rock for that April 1st Raw going into WrestleMania. And they've got SmackDown the night before Mania at the Wells Fargo Center, which is doubling up with the Hall of Fame that is already sold out. So it looks like this streak will be continuing for at least several more weeks, and I'm really curious to see if they experience a bit of a wave following WrestleMania, if there is coming out of the show that we have seen over the last 2 years. There was a lot of momentum coming out of the show.
Yeah, I mean, these year-over-year comparisons for WWE for all their event types has been pretty positive. I don't have an image ready for it, but it's continued to grow year-over-year. And we're still at the point for WWE, even though a lot of these events are nearing capacity, we're still looking at a lot of market-to-market comparisons for WWE events that are higher than the last time that same event type was in that venue. So there are some that are slightly lower, because I think they're kind of getting towards the high end of what's possible here. But we are continuing to see improvements compared to the last time they were there. Let's say, it's like 8 months or a year ago.
Also, last week, you might have missed this one. I don't know if you got a press release for it, but there was a quarterly earnings call for AEW's fourth quarter. It was exclusively housed by Josh Nason of the Wrestling Observer website, with Brandon Thurston going through all the key performance indicators for AEW in the fourth quarter of 2023. And going through some of the slides that you can get at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. Anything that jumped out at you crunching the numbers and looking at where they were, to put into context, this was a quarter that this was MJF and sort of the height of this whole devil storyline that culminated at the World's End pay-per-view at the end of the year. But that was kind of the dominant focus of television, also coinciding with Adam Copeland coming to the company and CM Punk leaving the company during this quarter.
As far as Q4, so we're talking October through the end of the year, Dynamite is down moderately, Rampage is down more severely, and Collision has no comparison. It's the rating story is, you know, it's lukewarm at best. It's slightly negative, both in terms of the demo and total viewership. If we look at tickets distributed from WrestleTickets, is where we're getting this data from. Total ticket sales, I assume, are way up based on the fact that you're running Collision every week, compared to last year where you were not running Collision at all. The average was basically flat, slightly up from the prior year, but we know, based on what's been happening in Q1, though, that if we look at this chart here, that ticket sales have continued to decline for Dynamite, which is at, you know, averaging quarter to date with only a couple weeks left in the quarter here, is averaging just under 4,000, which is substantially down from where they were a year ago in Q4 or even the trailing quarters, where Dynamite has really, in terms of moving tickets, has really cooled down. Part of that is probably due to the fact that they're running Collision as well, and that's increasing the frequency that they're going back to markets. Some of that may be just due to the content and just AEW not being as hot and going back to markets again, where it's not just the first time they've been there, maybe not even just the second time that they've been there, but maybe the third time that they've been there. Is it the lack of local promotion? Probably not that much. I know that's a thing that people bring up. Maybe that's a factor, but I think that the biggest thing here is just AEW is not as hot in this time as it was in the prior time. And I do think volume of events happening does have something to do with it.
And the final note we will mention, just a small item, and that is Bellator has now signed a streaming deal with Max, the Warner Brothers Discovery property. Bellator is now under the umbrella of the PFL, the Professional Fighters League, and this is for their champion series. There are going to be 8 events held throughout the year, starting with Friday's card in Belfast, Northern Ireland. So I know everyone is going to be logging on to Max Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern time for this card, that no financial deals disclosed in this streaming deal. I do not know how significant of a deal this is going to be for Bellator. I mean, it is a platform. They are also announcing this deal 48 hours before the event. So this was right down to the wire for U.S. consumption of this show.
Does this tell us anything about AEW getting some sort of deal on Max in terms of, this is a live event, live on Max, exclusively on Max. I know there's the BR Sports thing, and you can watch CNN on Max right now in the United States. And I think there's some baseball that's supposed to be on there. Maybe March Madness is going to be on there. But does this, I mean, certainly the technology is there. If they're going to do a live event in 2 days on Max, the technology is there, which was part of the reason we heard about why All In was not going to be an event on Max. So the capacity is certainly there. Is the deal there yet? Maybe we still have to wait until the NBA deal is done.
Yeah, and certainly I would say with the volume, I think even if we were to look at weekly programming, I think a typical episode of Collision is drawing a lot more eyeballs than a Bellator event. I would go so far as to say probably a Rampage is going to be doing more than Bellator in this current incarnation. I mean, this to me is not a... this is not going to be a giant deal for Max, but I would be curious to see what amount they are getting, if it's of any significance, that PFL/Bellator are getting for this deal.
And I would suggest if no one's leaking, it's not that impressive. You know,
you would think like something would have been, you know, coming out to give some of an indication of the health of this Bellator brand that they have acquired. But there you have it. That is all of the latest news that is going on. And we want to thank our guests. Before we get out of here, we do have one super chat. Let's go to Jake from the Windy City. Not shocked about the UFC settlement. If fighters don't go out of their way to wanting change, what's the point of us putting much energy into this? What do you think the discourse will be towards? This is certainly less of an issue, I would say, in the professional wrestling side as opposed to MMA, where it is a much more focused upon topic, fighter pay. You don't hear as much on the pro wrestling side of things when it comes to talent being paid. But I do wonder if this will somewhat make this more of a topic that kind of just is reserved for, is not as prominent of a topic moving forward, given that there is not going to be an antitrust suit to kind of drive the conversation. And
for
how
UFC
much
specifically?
For UFC specifically. Because I do feel it will be one that I think fighters will, like, it's still bizarre to me when I will hear a fighter like in the octagon and like occasionally mention, like, give me that $50,000 bonus, I'm broke. Like, that is a speech that, like, not an insignificant amount of times, like, you will hear on a pay-per-view or national television. And I just don't know how much fans are going to be necessarily invested in the topic.
Yeah, and UFC is profitable. It's more profitable than WWE is, which is plenty profitable on its own. But just UFC, I mean, given it runs fewer events, still runs events almost weekly, right? But they're not running quite two or three times a week, not to mention the house shows that WWE runs. And in addition to that, I mean, look at those ticket prices for those UFC events. We see really big gates, multiple millions of dollars.
$14 million last weekend in Miami.
You know, for their their numbered UFC events, which is, you know, we look at it as a really big deal in wrestling when there's $1 million gate for WWE as well as AEW. And we're in UFC, we're talking what, $14 million for an arena event, correct?
Yeah, this was at the Kaseya Center in Miami. So we're talking, the announced attendance was about 19,000 for $14 million. And as Mark Shapiro stated on that recent conference, when he hears about these records that they're hitting and immediate sellouts, we're not charging enough. And you can't even fault them for thinking that. I mean, it's as ridiculous as these prices are, there is a public that is spending the money on them. And I think they're going in one direction, and they're not to the average consumer to have affordable pricing.
$756 million in adjusted EBITDA.
There you have it.
That's a lot of adjusted EBITDA.
It's a lot of adjusting for everybody to get used to. Well, we are just a couple of weeks away from WrestleMania. Brandon and I will both be down in Philadelphia that week for all of the events that are going on. Do you have a loose plan of what you're going to be checking out beyond WrestleMania?
I think I'm getting there Friday afternoon, and I'm going to go to Supercard of Honor.
Okay.
And I'm going to go to WrestleMania Night 1 and WrestleMania Night 2. And then I'm going to go home on Monday. So those are my evening plans.
Where will WrestleNomics be taking place from? Will it be a road edition? Will it be a Monday edition? Have you not thought yet?
I've thought about it. It's going to be Monday evening, I think. And then there's the issue of the post WrestleMania Raw rating coming out. I am planning on doing it, I think, from a hotel Monday morning before I leave. Yeah, but I haven't thought about it enough, apparently. But yes, I won't be doing it Sunday morning because we'll only be halfway through WrestleMania at that time. I will probably do it Monday morning at a hotel room. Yeah.
All right. Well,
are you guys doing the post shows live for WrestleMania both nights at the usual time, like right after?
Not right after, because I'm planning to go to the press conference.
Yeah.
So it's going to be some late nights on Saturday and Sunday. I was actually going back to look at this, and I was trying to remember, did they do a press conference after both nights?
Oh,
and
they did.
They did last year. They did a Saturday and a Sunday one. So at least they are the WWE press conferences, and we know they will be contained to 60 minutes.
That's true. And they will start immediately after the show.
Yes. They will be interesting press conferences, I think, regardless. So Brandon and I are planning to be there. So we will see all of you down in Philadelphia, those that are traveling. But thank you to Eric McGraken and Todd Martin for joining us on the show, and all of you for tuning in. I I didn't want to point it out, but the Fabergé egg comparison did push us over 1,000 viewers. That did push us into four-figure live viewership. So
yeah, we need to analyze the minute by minutes and the quarter hours later, but we will have a full report on that later, maybe. And that did do well. We might have to add Todd Martin on again sometime.
I mean, the analogies galore. Todd is a great guest, as is Eric. So you can follow along, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can catch WrestleNomics every Sunday, unless he's on the road. And myself and Waiting are not going to be live tonight. Instead, we will be at Dynamite. So we're going to do a show Thursday, noon Eastern, on the Post Wrestling YouTube channel, going through our live thoughts of Dynamite and Rampage and getting it in right at the end. I fell for this one. Anyway, we're getting an odd super chatter that I don't really know.
We appreciate everyone's super chats, though.
Yeah. All right. Thanks to everyone for joining us. That is it for us. And you have now got your fix of Pollock and Thurston. Goodbye.